Hello, good friends.
Help you?
Yeah, can I have a dozen red roses, please?
Oh, hi, Johnny. I didn't know it was you. Here you go.
That's me. How much is it?
It'll be $18.
Here you go. Keep the change. Hi, doggy.
You're my favorite customer.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I did not hit her. It's not true. It's bullshit. I did not hit her. I did not.
Oh, hi, Mark.
You can come out now, Johnny. She's gone.
In a few minutes, bitch.
People are very strange these days. I used to know a girl. She had a dozen guys. One of them found out about it, beat her up so bad she ended up in a hospital on Guerrero Street.
What a story, Mark.
You are lying. I nearly hit you. You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
If you're under 40 years old, you probably know exactly where those clips I just played are from. If you're over 40 years old but sexy, you might know as well. Even if the iconic opening music didn't clue you in right away, which it could've, you almost definitely recognized the source of those clips by the time we got to this line.
You're tearing me apart, Lisa!
But because I try to be non-judgmental on this show, I'll go ahead and tell you where that's from. Even though you kind of have to be one of the web-footed people under Grand Central to not recognize that line in 2025. It's from The Room, 2003. The best and worst movie of all time. Possibly the 21st century's most iconic cult film, The Room's hilarious awfulness transcends mere meme status. It's a genuine cultural touchstone. For those who haven't seen it, I think it's best described as what would happen if you told an alien what movies are, and then the alien decided that it would go ahead and make one of those. It has all the features of a real movie. It's just deliciously off. Why are the love scenes so long and boring? It's not an adult movie, it's the least arousing thing you'll ever see! Why do characters seemingly change their motivation and thoughts toward others mid-scene? Why are there framed photos of spoons all over the place? Why is there a subplot involving a drug dealer that doesn't go anywhere? Why are there two logos for the same studio at the beginning? Why does one character say they're dying of cancer at one point and then immediately forget about it for the rest of the movie?
Ah! Why, Lisa? Why?
Why? Ultimately, every question about The Room comes down to the mastermind of the entire film. The writer, director, producer, and lead actor, Tommy Wiseau, who sounds like a drunk Dracula and looks the part too, with his long, matted black hair. The movie was entirely Tommy Wiseau's brainchild. He spent years working on The Room, financing it with his own money, writing and rewriting a script that doesn't sound like it was written by anyone at all, hiring a cast of unemployed LA wannabe actors, and finally stumbling through the minutiae of how to actually direct a film while acting in it, if you can call it directing or acting. When Tommy finally, to the surprise of everyone else involved, finished the movie, he entered it to qualify for the Oscars. Even today, with The Room regularly playing to packed theaters worldwide and fans performing Rocky Horror-style audience participation rituals, I'm not sure Tommy really realizes that people like The Room because of how inept it is. So what's the deal with this guy? Who is Tommy Wiseau? And here we get to what a lot of fans of The Room consider a quintessential part of the movie's appeal. That's the beauty of him. He isn't anyone. Indeed, Tommy Wiseau has never publicly disclosed any of the following things. 1. His real age. When asked, he usually responds, same age as you, no matter the age of the person asking. 2. His country of origin. He used to tell people he was from New Orleans, but finally realized nobody was buying that. He now admits he wasn't born in America, but doesn't get any more specific than that. 3. His real name. Tommy Wiseau is almost definitely not his birth name because there's no record of the surname Wiseau existing in any context prior to the media coverage of The Room. Or 4. How he got all his money. Because Tommy Wiseau is filthy rich. Most movies are financed by several producers who sign on to fund a project they think will make money in exchange for a cut of the profits. In keeping with The Room's aesthetic of doing everything most movies do just in a slightly misinterpreted way, the opening credits of The Room do list several producers, except that of them, only Tommy Wiseau was ever involved in producing The Room or any other film, and one of the credited producers on The Room was dead when it was being made. We'll look into who those people really were once we've gotten a little further down the rabbit hole, but the first takeaway you should be getting here is that the only real producer on The Room was Tommy Wiseau, financing the film out of his own pocket. And them's some deep pockets. The Room is estimated to have cost $6 million, and Tommy made some questionable and expensive decisions during the pre-production of the film, such as choosing to shoot in digital and film stock simultaneously, and to buy his camera equipment instead of renting it. All of this was done as casually as if he was just putting a quarter in a parking meter, suggesting Tommy has more than just those $6 million in his bank account. So, Tommy Wiseau is a man who refuses to discuss his backstory, is a multimillionaire, comes from some foreign country, and thinks this is Oscar-worthy dialogue.
You know what they say, love is blind.
How was work today?
Oh, pretty good. We got a new client at the bank. We'll make a lot of money.
What client?
I cannot tell you. It's confidential.
Oh, come on. Why not?
No, I can't. Anyway, how is your sex life?
It's not over. Everybody betrayed me. I fed up with this world.
You can love someone deep inside your heart, and there is nothing wrong with it. If a lot of people love each other, the world would be a better place to live.
And given what we're about to get into, that's the tip of the iceberg regarding how weird Tommy can get. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my newly adorned co-host, Jollibee the Durian, and Thimble Dahl. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. You could stop at 5 or 6 journalistic accounts of how The Room was made, or just one. If you're looking to piece together what little we do know about Tommy Wiseau's life before The Room, your best bet is probably The Disaster Artist, a memoir written in 2014 by Greg Sestero. He was the actor who played Mark, who is sort of the secondary villain in The Room, the handsome young man who gets seduced by the evil, beautiful Lisa, cheating on her future husband, Johnny, played, of course, by Tommy Wiseau, who presumably doesn't know the word fiancé since it's never used to describe Johnny or Lisa anywhere in the movie. Greg knew Tommy for a few years before the production of The Room got underway, having first met him in 1998 in an acting class in San Francisco. Greg had done some modeling as a teenager, and like many a young attractive man, he had dreams of hitting it big in Hollywood. Understandably, he was a little weirded out the first time he met Tommy, but Tommy shared his dream of being a movie star, and while Greg and everyone else in that acting class naturally thought Tommy had a snowball's chance of becoming a star, Tommy did have a crucial asset that Greg didn't, an apartment he owned in Los Angeles. Greg moved to LA, staying at Tommy's apartment, auditioning for various movies, and getting a few minor roles. In the book, The Disaster Artist, which is probably the most authoritative source we'll ever get on Tommy Wiseau's life before The Room, Greg depicts life with Tommy as a constant stream of inexplicable oddities, some of them random and hilarious, others genuinely suspicious. Tommy is described wearing sunglasses, indoors and at night. He has to write down the keypad code to get into his apartment complex because he can't remember it. According to Greg, the code at the time was 1234. Tommy once refused to let a valet park his car, out of fear the valet would fart on the driver's seat, and later lashed out at someone else for farting on the set of The Room. He asked a woman if her dog was real. He uses Mickey Mouse as an adjective, which based on the context seems to mean something along the lines of janky or phony. He orders glasses of hot water at restaurants, which is common in China, interestingly, but Tommy is definitely not Chinese, and I don't know of any other country where that's a thing. He has a basically nocturnal sleep schedule, eats a full Thanksgiving dinner all by himself on every day in November, but otherwise subsists on ramen and Red Bull, and claims to believe in the actual physical existence of vampires. But Tommy Wiseau's quirks can get more sinister. During the time he and Greg Sestero lived together, he would disappear for weeks at a time, claiming he had business obligations to fulfill, although he never told Greg what his job was. At one point, Tommy said he had to go to London, but from the time of day he would call Greg and the dial tone used by the landline phone, Greg deduced that he was actually still somewhere in the US. He once became paranoid that somebody was trying to poison him. He once decided to buy Greg an SUV on the spur of the moment, but refused to show the salesman any ID, going to 3 different dealerships until he found one that was sketchy enough to take the money no questions asked. Sometimes, late at night, Tommy would skulk off to his side of the apartment, which he kept separate from Greg's side with a heavy curtain, and spend hours on the phone with somebody, speaking English. Though Greg could rarely make out the words, these conversations always seemed to be very emotional, and Tommy would sometimes break down crying. And in what is perhaps the most surreal passage in The Disaster Artist, towards the end of the production on The Room, Tommy takes Greg back to the Bay Area, where they both lived before their respective attempts to break into Hollywood, and shows Greg the building he owns in San Francisco, which he has never mentioned up to that point in the years they've been roommates. The building, which is still owned by Tommy Wiseau today, is a valuable piece of real estate right by Ghirardelli Square on the waterfront, and it's described in The Disaster Artist as a real dump, in the middle of an otherwise upmarket area. It includes a grubby pizza joint called Pizza Zone, offices, and a handful of other businesses, but the majority of the building is taken up by a shop called Street Fashions USA. Greg describes the place as warehouse-like, without any apparent cash registers, selling mountains of very low-quality jeans with stitching errors and belt loops in the wrong places. When Greg visited Street Fashions USA, it was closed, even though it was the middle of the day on a weekday, and there were no employees anywhere. Nonetheless, Street Fashions USA seemed to be the anchor of Tommy's building, evidenced by the 10-foot fiberglass pair of pants sitting above the building's main entrance. On the building's roof, there are a pair of gigantic American flags with TPW for Thomas Pierre Wiseau engraved at the base of the flagpoles. Yes, Tommy's middle name is Pierre. He also claims his flags are the largest in San Francisco, and they might be. Tommy talks about how he loves America constantly. He's brimming with the patriotism of the immigrant. His building is still roughly the same today. You can drive past it on Street View at 550 Beach Street in San Francisco. I visited it a few years ago. Street Fashions USA closed long ago, but Pizza Zone, the giant flagpoles, and the giant pants are still clearly there, plus a gigantic sun-bleached poster for The Room, featuring Tommy's face glowering down on passersby in case anyone doubts who still owns the building. Even today, Greg is probably Tommy's closest known confidant, including the person he would emotionally call late at night, because I think we have decent circumstantial evidence, which I'll get into later, as to who that was. But knowing Tommy Wiseau better than anybody else does not mean Greg Sestero knows Tommy well. He clearly has learned more about Tommy's backstory than the rest of us, but I'm pretty sure there are holes in even his understanding. In the book The Disaster Artist, Greg publishes some tantalizing hints into Tommy's past while acknowledging he has no way of confirming them. The story Greg paints goes something like this. In an Eastern European country, not long after the death of Stalin, a young boy is born. His hometown was 79% destroyed just a decade before in World War II, his father is absent, for reasons never explained to Greg, and his family is poor. This kid, whose name was probably some variation of Thomas, Peter, or Johnny, is obsessed with America from a young age. As a teenager, the person later known as Tommy Wiseau illegally sells posters of American movie stars on the street. As a young man, he and a cousin of his hear rumors that Strasbourg, France, a mid-sized city by the French-German border, is unusually tolerant of illegal immigrants from communist countries, and they make plans to escape their crumbling country. They bribe the right people and, after a long bus ride, arrive in France. Strasbourg isn't the refuge they hoped it would be. The PLKTW, person later known as Tommy Wiseau, and his cousin get jobs washing dishes in a restaurant, but pretty soon the cousin is arrested and deported. PLKTW manages to escape arrest, and gradually his French begins to improve. He starts going by Pierre. In the dead of winter, the hostel where Pierre lives is raided by police, who found drugs on the premises. Pierre has nothing to do with it, but he is arrested anyway, and, according to Tommy, telling this story decades later, a pair of sadistic cops beat him and play Russian roulette with him, then throw him out into the snow. Pierre is taken in by an older man, a chapter of his life that he was later reluctant to tell Greg about, though he claims he ran away after the man offered Pierre money to suck him off, and in response, Pierre trashed the man's apartment. Pierre lives on the streets for a while, somehow earning money, doing something. Greg admits he has no idea what, until he somehow hears from an uncle of his who he didn't know existed. His name is Stanley, and he lives in Louisiana, in the United States, with his wife Catherine. Pierre begs to join them and somehow manages to get a sponsorship from the Red Cross and a French passport. How did Stanley know where Pierre was and how to contact him? What's the deal with the alleged Red Cross sponsorship and the heavily implied to be fake passport? No idea. Even Greg doesn't know. This is one of the murkier bits in the extremely murky life of Tommy Wiseau. I don't think we'll ever know the full story of how the individual then known as Pierre made it to America, but somehow, in the span of under a year, he went from a homeless, practically stateless illegal immigrant all alone in France to living with his uncle Stanley and Aunt Catherine in the small town of Chalmette, Louisiana, working a minimum wage bagging groceries at the local Schwegman's supermarket. Uncle Stanley and Aunt Catherine are nice, but Louisiana isn't too interesting, and Pierre dreams of going somewhere else in America. California, maybe. Traveling into New Orleans on the weekends, Pierre, still speaking French better than he can speak English, befriends a French guitarist named Jean-Luc, who recommends that Pierre should go to San Francisco. With a paltry paycheck from Schwegman's in hand, Pierre gets on a Greyhound across the country. At last, an exact year is given for when this is happening. 1978. In San Francisco, staying at a YMCA, Pierre decides, new city, new me, and from then on he goes by the name Thomas. Within weeks, he's got a job with a shady local salesman, hawking yo-yos and toy birds to tourists on Fisherman's Wharf. He begins making money. Lots of money. More money than Greg can believe he must have actually been making. The stories Tommy later tells Greg are self-contradictory. Sometimes he claims he was unimaginably poor. Other times, he says he was so rich he carried home sacks of cash every night. After a few apparently successful months, Thomas breaks away from the guy who originally hired him, and sells toys on his own, and takes a second job, working at a reportedly mob-connected Italian restaurant. Locals begin to know him as Birdman for the toy birds he sells, and he decides to adopt Wiseau, a variant spelling of the French word for bird, oiseau, as his new surname. Slowly but surely, and once again, Greg doubts that this is anywhere close to the whole story, the man now known as Tommy Wiseau begins amassing a fortune. As he worked at the Italian restaurant, Tommy had a failed romantic relationship. Greg will later speculate was the inspiration for the plot of The Room, in which Tommy's character is betrayed by his best friend and his fiancé and driven to end his life. Years afterward, Tommy met a man named Drew Caffrey. In the search for a coherent backstory for Tommy Wiseau, which a lot of fans of The Room have joined in vain, Drew Caffrey looms large, not least because Tommy admired the man enough to credit him as one of the producers for The Room, as well as its casting director. Even though Greg claims Caffrey died in 1999, 4 years before The Room ever came out. There is scant evidence that Drew Caffrey ever existed, besides Tommy's effusive praise for him on several occasions, and Caffrey's vanity credit as a producer on The Room. And even Greg knows very little about him, but he's got enough of a paper trail that I'd say Occam's Razor says he was a real person. In the 1990s, Greg claims, Tommy Wiseau and Drew Caffrey owned a little stand together selling plastic trinkets to tourists. More yo-yos, more toy birds. Somehow, the two of them amass the money to buy a building near Ghirardelli Square, tear it down, and build a new four-story headquarters for their business, which we now know as the Pants and Pizza Zone building on Beach Street. In fact, this wasn't the only property Tommy and Drew Caffrey owned. In the late 90s, there were several Street Fashions USA locations across San Francisco, and briefly even one in Los Angeles, plus at least one apartment building the two of them owned, which burned down in 1995, killing one person. Greg says Tommy sort of made his first movie in response to the fire, in order to demonstrate the damage so he could get an insurance payout. The video, which is not available on the internet, although Tommy seems to have allowed Greg to watch it, apparently shows news footage of the fire set to a dramatic classical score, as well as a section in which Tommy, behind the camera, urges Drew Caffrey, who is inexplicably wearing a white lab coat, to say good things about Tommy's character. Caffrey supposedly died in 1999. Possibly of AIDS, although nothing is too clear surrounding this man, and that same year, Tommy began taking acting classes, perhaps spurred by his business partner's death to branch out and start pursuing his lifelong dreams. The rest is history. Now, everything you just heard, everything since the intro, comes from a single source, Greg Sestero's book, The Disaster Artist, and not even Greg himself is sure any of these stories are accurate. It's just stuff he's pieced together from the little Tommy has told him about his life before he met Greg. But Tommy probably didn't make it all up, because in a few places, there are a handful of other clues corroborating these accounts of his life. Let's start with Tommy's birth. Greg leaves three key clues for determining Tommy's country of birth. It was a communist Eastern Bloc country, his home city was heavily damaged in World War II, and he grew up living near a major Catholic cathedral, indicating it was probably a country with a significant Catholic population. There are two countries that check all these boxes, Poland and Hungary. Most Tommy sleuths have settled on Poland as his probable country of origin for a few reasons, some of which come from The Disaster Artist, while others come directly from the room itself. First, in The Disaster Artist, Greg says that Tommy's squalid bus ride escape from his home country involved a layover in Berlin, which is close to Poland, but a long way across several countries from Hungary. If Tommy were going to France from Hungary, probably in the late 60s or early 70s, he'd probably have crossed the Iron Curtain in Vienna, not Berlin. Also, much later, Greg mentions that Tommy chose to spell his newly created last name, Oiseau, with a W instead of the O from the French word oiseau his name was otherwise based on, because long before he was Tommy Oiseau, he allegedly told Greg his original last name started with a W. Hungarian, which is a weird language unrelated to anything else in Central Europe, doesn't use the W, whereas Polish, which is a weird language related to a few other slightly less weird Slavic languages, is pretty much all W's. And the movie The Room itself contains evidence that its writer, director, producer, and star was a Pole. There's a moment towards the end of The Room in which Mark, who's Greg Sestero's character, gets in a fight with a character who just showed up two-thirds of the way through the movie without any introduction and never gets a name, but is referred to in the credits as Steven. In the process of getting mad at Steven, Mark spits the following baffling even for The Room line.
Leave your stupid comments in your pocket.
In The Disaster Artist, Greg says that he couldn't even imagine Liam Neeson saying that line convincingly, and he was only able to say it with the requisite amount of venom by summoning all the anger he had towards Tommy Wiseau for dragging him into this catastrophic movie. But a Polish fan of The Room claims this is a verbatim translation of a Polish idiom, generally seen as archaic, but still widely recognized. I'm gonna try to pronounce this. Zostaw, something unwanted, w kieszeni. It means, leave your... something unwanted in your pocket. Another iconic scene in The Room, and I'm going to stop using that word because absolutely every scene in The Room is iconic, depicts Lisa, conniving, manipulative Lisa, conniving and manipulative for no apparent reason other than women, am I right, trying to get her, quote, future husband Johnny drunk. She takes out two glasses half full of an amber liquid and pours vodka into each of them. Nobody gives any indication of what the amber liquid is, but fans believe it's scotch, and the so-called scotchka has become the signature cocktail of The Room. It fits with the aesthetic of The Room, as a movie directed by an alien that thinks it understands human behavior and culture, but not as well as it believes it does. Having read The Disaster Artist, I can totally picture Tommy asking Greg on the set of The Room something along the lines of this.
When people drinking alcohol,
What they drink? Wine? Beer? Cocktails? What is cocktails? Well, it's when you, like, mix a few different kinds of alcohol together, you serve it in a little glass.
I get it! Thank you, Greg!
He proceeds to go out to a liquor store and gets the two first bottles of hard alcohol he sees, which turn out to be vodka and scotch. I can picture this happening, but it probably didn't. A few Polish fans of the room have speculated that the amber liquid isn't scotch, it's apple juice. And the drink that Lisa tries to get Johnny drunk on is a cocktail of vodka and apple juice, which is commonplace where else? In Poland. And some people who have attempted to go further down the rabbit hole than Greg have corroborated the theory that Tommy is Polish. Rick Harper, the director of the upcoming documentary Room Full of Spoons, claims to have discovered that Tommy was born in 1955 in Poznan, Poland, which, sure enough, is a Polish cathedral city that sustained heavy bombing in World War II. How Harper found this information is unclear, and presumably there will be further background to this claim when Room Full of Spoons comes out, only that might be never, since Tommy Wiseau keeps suing Harper in every way he legally can to prevent the movie's release. Now, this may suggest that Room Full of Spoons really lays Tommy's past bare and it's full of answers that Tommy doesn't want getting out. There's a lot of anticipation of the documentary's eventual release in the Room fan circles for this particular reason, but I wouldn't be so sure. Tommy is incredibly jealous and incredibly guarding of his past. I managed to find courtroom transcripts from one of Tommy's lawsuits against Harper, and in defending himself against charges of libel and invasion of privacy, Harper says only about 5 minutes of Room Full of Spoons are devoted to Tommy's background, and the documentary is mostly about the room's fandom. So it seems like Tommy is just really angry about the revelation of his actual age and birthplace, a time and place that aren't big surprises given what we already know. The next chapter in Tommy's life story, as told by Greg, is totally uncorroborated, but this shouldn't be a surprise. If he was working as an illegal immigrant in Strasbourg, France in the 70s, possibly for years, although there's no indication of how long he was there, I doubt there would be any documentation of his existence. The Red Cross sponsorship lead is promising, and the website of the American Red Cross says they can reunite families and find missing family members in foreign countries. Usually this means in war and refugee-related situations, but maybe young Tommy qualified. But the Red Cross explicitly says they can't help bring a family member suffering a humanitarian crisis to America. They can help locate them, but that's where their job ends. So however Tommy got to Louisiana, it wasn't through the Red Cross. Greg strongly suggests that there was a lot that happened to Tommy in France he isn't letting on to, though, so this period in his life will probably stay a mystery for now. While Tommy himself has never specifically named Strasbourg as a place he used to live, he has publicly claimed that he once lived in France, also naming an incident that, if it really happened, I'm surprised didn't get a mention in Greg's book. Supposedly, while living in France, he was in a car with some girls, no further explanation of why or who they were, and they got into an accident where the car flipped upside down into a pond and they had to escape as it began filling up with water. Quoth Tommy, "It was like Titanic." I went to a screening of The Room in Portland about a year ago that Tommy himself attended. Here's me in my Tommy cosplay, that's what I made this for, and Tommy with his many belts. Before the showing, Tommy did a Q&A with the audience where people could step up to the mic and ask him a question, although he deflected a lot of questions with, "Move on, next question." I decided to confirm if he really speaks French, because I speak French, but I wanted to avoid mentioning anything about his past, since he's liable to just move on, next question, those ones. So when I stepped up to the mic, I asked him, without any warning, that I'd start speaking in French. Il y a quelques ans, sur l'émission d'Howard Stern, j'ai entendu que vous avez dit que vous parlez français. C'est vrai ça? Vous voulez parler français avec moi? So he responded, in an accent as terrible as the one he uses in English.
Well, je parle français, but this is America, and we speak English here.
The crowd roared with laughter. Okay. I'd confirmed that he speaks some French, which is something that I feel like we already kinda knew, but if he really didn't seem to understand, that would be a signal that we are totally barking up the wrong tree and his entire loosely sketched background might be a myth. Looks like it's not. but he didn't say move on next question, presumably because he was so taken aback by someone speaking French to him, so I decided to take the opportunity to ask another, riskier question. See, in the fandom for The Room, it's taken as gospel that the movie costs $6 million to make. That number gets thrown around a lot because it's so absurd. I am certain that even today, after two decades of inflation, what we see on screen could have been made for a five-digit sum total. Where did all that money go? Well, it's definitely confirmed that Tommy had no knowledge or interest in cutting corners. Again, he bought his expensive film equipment instead of renting it. Two sets of expensive film equipment, each of which required its own crew, because he wasn't sure if he wanted to film in digital or film stock, and went,
¿Por qué no los dos?
Why not both? Which required the crew to invent a whole new type of camera setup to film them both at once. The released version was the one shot on 35mm film, and the digital version of The Room is probably lost media, albeit it's not that high on my list of lost media I want found because it's just the same movie. Tommy built sets when he could have filmed it in a real apartment, including putting in plumbing for a working toilet only he was allowed to use that never appears on screen. He fired the whole crew and brought on new ones anywhere from 2 to 4 times, depending on who you ask, and extended the production weeks longer than it was planned to last, requiring him to recast one character, Peter, whose actor had a strict time limit. He brought in a different guy, who looked absolutely nothing like Peter, which is why that guy Steven appears all of a sudden in the final act. When Steven first appears, I love to shout, "Who the fuck are you?" Because everyone in the movie is acting like they know him because his lines were intended for Peter, but we, the audience, have never seen Steven before and never get an explanation for where he came from. Anyway, despite all these ridiculous choices, I'm still not confident the budget was that high. I have traced the claim that The Room cost 6,000 grand back to a 2008 article in Entertainment Weekly, and no further than that. I talked to a film professor at my alma mater, Lewis and Clark College, who knows a lot specifically about the logistics of making a big movie. Even with all of Tommy's expensive fuck-ups, he said that the max he could imagine The Room having cost was $2 million. So that night, having the opportunity to ask Tommy questions in front of an audience, I next asked, in English this time, how much did The Room really cost to make? People in the media have been saying $6 million, is that correct? Higher? Lower? And Tommy replied, how much it cost you to live for 20 years? Tommy is known for consistently underestimating everyone's age. The weirdest character in The Room besides him is a guy named Denny, who is supposed to be a college student, but the actor's obviously quite a bit older, and sometimes the script has him acting more like he's 10. But I was 22 at the time, so he was close. Tommy then proclaimed, "Move on, next question," and I returned to my seat, satisfied in having been publicly roasted by Tommy Wiseau. But we know Tommy speaks French, and we're pretty confident his claims of living in Louisiana are true, too. Here, some actual detective work has been done to confirm his stories. Uncle Stanley and Aunt Catherine were probably real. The Reddit user OhByMark, who has a very good username, has discovered obituaries for a couple named Stanley and Kathleen, who lived in Chalmette, Louisiana, and were about the right age to be one generation older than Tommy Wiseau, if Tommy really was born in the 50s. Their surname was Viechor, W-I-E-C-Z-O-R, which is pretty similar to Wiseau, and Stanley's birth name was Stanislav Wieczorkiewicz. I'm not saying these two are definitely Tommy's Polish-American aunt and uncle, especially since Stanley's wife is named Kathleen, not Catherine, and Stanley's obituary lists lots of relatives, none of whom go by a name that could be a variation on Thomas, Peter, or Wiseau. But there would have to be a lot of coincidences for there to be a Polish couple old enough to be Tommy's aunt and uncle with names similar to Stanley and Catherine in the small, obscure town in Louisiana where Tommy says he lived with his aunt and uncle. I'd say that these people probably were the Uncle Stanley and Aunt Catherine. Kathleen is similar enough to Catherine that Tommy's accent could easily have made one sound like the other. And Stanley's obituary mentions that Stanley had 5 siblings, so he probably had so many nieces and nephews the obit would be too long if they named any of them. But then, presumably, Tommy headed off to San Francisco to seek his fortune. throwing him and us into the most mysterious period of his life. Tommy's paper trail dries up here, and for a decade and a half, from his arrival in San Francisco in 1978 to the appearance of his name in legal documents and property deeds in the mid-90s, we truly don't know what he was doing. Interestingly, there are records of him incorporating a business called Street Fashions in 1979, but this seems to initially have just been the name of a souvenir stand. The only thing we have to go off are his cursory summaries of this time recorded by Greg in The Disaster Artist, and those really don't help us get to the bottom of the biggest mystery about Tommy's life, how he made his millions, which is still totally unknown. Let's start by investigating who Drew Caffrey could have been. His name appears on a few property deeds jointly with Tommy's in San Francisco in the 90s. On Find a Grave, I found a person named Andrew Caffrey Jr., who died in 1999 at the age of 68 and is buried in Los Angeles. His grave says he served in the Korean War. This is the only person by the name of Drew or Andrew Caffrey I could find who died in the 90s anywhere in the United States. So the fact that he died in 1999 in California is strong circumstantial evidence that this is our Drew Caffrey. IMDb, which has a page for him because of his not actually producer credit on The Room, says he was born in 1931, which is the same birth year listed on Andrew Caffrey Jr.'s grave in LA, and fits with Greg's description of Caffrey as being about 20 years older than Tommy. So Drew Caffrey probably existed. The trail goes completely cold there. Except for a recently discovered piece of the puzzle. The testimony from a man named Aaron, who claims to have worked at Street Fashions USA and was interviewed a few years ago on the Film Drunk podcast. The big takeaways there are, well, first of all, that Street Fashions USA absolutely was a real store, not a money laundering front, and people actually worked there. But in terms of things we really didn't know before, this employee Aaron, who worked at Street Fashions USA under Tommy's leadership for 11 years in the 80s and 90s, says that Tommy had another business partner, a guy named Eli, who allegedly also co-owned properties with Tommy, and allegedly also died in the late 90s, also leaving the remains of his mini-business empire to Tommy. I know what you're thinking, and I highly doubt it. Eli supposedly died of AIDS, which some sources say is what Drew Caffrey died of, too, so I don't know if this is someone confusing the two, or if Eli was a pseudonym for Drew Caffrey, but it's also possible they both separately died of AIDS, since San Francisco was pretty hard hit by the AIDS epidemic in the 90s. The other bombshell is this guy Aaron's claim that Tommy had a brother who helped build the stockrooms in the multiple Street Fashions USA stores, which is a pretty big claim, since it implies Tommy was still in contact with at least some of his family back in Poland. I don't get that impression at all from Greg's account of Tommy's life. The other person credited as an executive producer on The Room, alongside Tommy and Drew Caffrey, was a woman named Chloe Lietzky, and she has enough of a paper trail to prove that she was definitely a real person. Lietzky, who died in 2012, was an English as a second language teacher at a community college in Oakland, where Tommy attended classes in the late 80s in a fruitless attempt to get rid of his accent. Sometimes Tommy claims he also got a degree in psychology there. According to Greg, Tommy and Chloe Lietzky became friends, and he believes that she was probably the person who Tommy would emotionally call in English every now and then. There are unfounded theories that Lietzky was his sugar mama, and this is how he made his money, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But there's also a wealth of fascinating information out there about Lietzky that suggests more plausible things about Tommy's life. Reddit user Brickyard Jimmy, in what may be the deepest dive anyone has done into Tommy's business history, uncovered legal documents from a 2004 lawsuit Chloe Lietzky and her husband Fred filed against Tommy Wiseau. Apparently, the Lietzkys had loaned Tommy hundreds of thousands of dollars to make improvements on a property they were leasing from him, but Tommy had never paid them back, so they sued. Brickyard Jimmy suggests that Tommy had used this money to promote The Room, since when he released it, after spending maybe up to $6 million of his own money to make the film, he spent years renting out theaters and inviting people to come see The Room for free, until the film finally became successful, though not in the way Tommy expected, and turned a profit. This must have been a significant expense on its own, and it's possible that as rich as Tommy was, he may have spent much of his life savings on making The Room. According to property deeds, he also sold one of his San Francisco properties for almost $3 million in 2002, right as he was finishing up work on The Room, which could also imply that he was broke and needed to free up more money. So maybe Tommy took the loan the Lieskis were giving him for property improvements and spent it on his pursuit of Hollywood stardom instead, incorrectly assuming that his movie was just so good he'd make enough money from The Room in time to pay it back. Plausible? Sure, maybe, and it kind of explains why Chloe Lietzky had a random credit as a producer on The Room. Tommy knows that the producers are the people who finance the film, so looking around for names other than his own to list as producers, he hit upon listing people who had allowed him to self-finance the production and marketing of The Room. Drew Caffrey, for his help with the Street Fashions USA business empire, and Chloe Lietzky, for the misappropriated loan he used to advertise his movie. For the past few months, I have been pursuing another lead about Tommy's past, with ties to these two people. An individual who I am quite confident knew Tommy in the 90s, and I haven't found evidence that any other Tommy sleuths have interviewed this person or even know about their existence. I will not disclose any identifying information because this person's contact info can be easily found online, and while I think it's out of date, I don't want them exposed to the harsh light of the internet. I'll give you this. If you have attended online classes within the past few years at a particular community college in the North Bay area, and with the rest of the details in this video, you think you're picking up what I'm putting down, reach out to me directly. You know where to find me. Knowing where my viewers tend to live and what they're into, I hope there will be at least one person watching this who knows someone who knows this person. But I doubt you know they know Tommy Wiseau. If I ever get to pursue that lead, that may be the biggest bombshell I've ever broken on Tor's cabinet. But we could find a smoking gun telling us that everything we know so far about Drew Caffrey and Chloe Lietzky is true, and still be no closer to answering the burning question.
Where's my money?
Where did his money come from? How did Tommy go from selling toy birds and other cheap plastic junk on the San Francisco waterfront to owning prime San Francisco real estate and being able to fund an entire movie out of his pocket? I think it's at long last time to bring up another confirmed piece of his backstory, the 1996 car crash. In 1996, Tommy was seriously injured in a two-vehicle car accident in San Francisco, in which a tourist in a rental car ran a red light and slammed into Tommy's car at an intersection. Tommy sued the rental car company and was awarded damages, though the exact amount is unknown. Back when Tommy was still claiming he was from New Orleans, a few Room sleuths embraced the car accident as a magic bullet theory that cleared up every mystery around him. Supposedly, winning a lawsuit after the accident can explain his wealth, and brain injuries sustained in the accident can explain his accent and eccentricity. None of this is likely to be true. While getting a foreign-sounding accent after a traumatic brain injury isn't unheard of, the strong evidence that Tommy is from Poland has put a damper on that part of the theory. But is it possible he really was an ordinary, socially competent Polish immigrant before the accident and became Tommy Wiseau after sustaining brain damage? Probably not that either. Legal documents from the aftermath of the crash, which is where all this information is coming from, don't make any reference to Tommy having mental damage as a result of the crash, and he's said to have made a full recovery from his physical injuries. And did he get rich off the lawsuit? Maybe richer. But he was already rich. There's evidence that Tommy owned high-value real estate in San Francisco as early as 1992, and possibly before, when publicly accessible property deeds show the ownership of a large suite in the Fisherman's Wharf area was transferred from Tommy Wiseau the individual to something called the Thomas P. Wiseau Revocable Trust, which sounds kind of tax evasion-y to me. So, not only was Tommy rich before the car crash, he already knew how to stay rich and exploit financial loopholes before the car crash. One thing Tommy himself credits the car crash with doing, in the disaster artist's only mention of this momentous occasion in his life, is sparking a midlife crisis, and leading to his first unsuccessful attempt to break into Hollywood. Greg claims to have talked to some of the acting teachers he took classes with during this period. Tommy even made a student film around this time, called Robbery Doesn't Pay, which Greg describes as just a guy walking around looking at cars to Blue Monday by Orgy. There's a lot of misinformation online about Tommy. The mystery of his origins is one of the internet's favorite enigmas, and a month rarely goes by when someone doesn't post on the Reddit forum dedicated to the room claiming to have exclusive dirt on Tommy's background, then deleting their post when people ask for further details. Someone once claimed to be an ex-lover of his who had a sex tape of him, which, why? We've all already seen that, and we don't want to. More plausibly, I once saw a Reddit comment claiming that Tommy had a relative in Poland who died 6 months before he began purchasing real estate in San Francisco, heavily implying Tommy inherited a fortune. As compelling as this sounds, since it is admittedly difficult to imagine someone as weird as Tommy being a self-made entrepreneur, I don't believe it for a number of reasons. First, this is a pretty big bombshell. It would clear up the biggest mystery surrounding him, so if there was a paper trail to prove it, it would be pretty big news. It would get more attention than just being pointed out in some random Reddit comment somewhere. Second, the prospect of having a rich relative in Poland doesn't square with the rest of his story. His uncle Stanley and Aunt Kathleen weren't rich, assuming we found the right people, and Tommy definitely lived hand-to-mouth for decades. To have a relative back home kick it and leave millions of zlotys to the itinerant black sheep of the family who left the country years ago when there are apparently many other family members who could have received the money and probably would have been trusted to keep it better doesn't sound too realistic to me. Third, if you were rich in communist Poland around then, you would have to be a high-ranking member of the Communist Party. There weren't a lot of corporate titans or media celebrities or anything in Poland around then. All the economic power was in the hands of either the government or the black market. If anyone at all in Tommy's family was a Polish government figure, Tommy wouldn't have had a very difficult childhood, and he probably wouldn't have been motivated to skip the country and work under the table in France. Even if he had, his family and/or the Polish government would likely pursue him. By now, long after the fall of Polish communism, there would be some evidence somewhere of a party official whose rebellious son fled to America, and somebody would have put two and two together. And if he's from a communist-era Polish crime family, I mean... No, I guess I could believe that. Actually, considering everything else we know about the guy, this genuinely might be the most plausible solution. But then, the length of time cited 6 months before Tommy started his real estate empire is implausibly precise, because we don't know when he started buying up real estate. The earliest we can track it is to that transfer of ownership from himself to himself on the Fisherman's Wharf property, which was in 1992. But he may have owned that building for years before that, or he could have just bought it. It was recently discovered that the Spanish Wikipedia, of all places, seems to have an exact date and location of birth, and birth name, for Tommy Wiseau. It lists his birth date as October 3rd, 1955, his birthplace as Poznan, Poland, and his birth name as Tomasz Wieczorkiewicz. None of these are a surprise. Anyone who's gone down the Who is Tommy rabbit hole will have run into evidence that he was born in Poland in the 50s. Tomasz Wieczorkiewicz is about the most likely birth name for him, because Tomasz is the Polish version of Thomas, and Wieczorkiewicz was Uncle Stanley's original surname, and the Roomful of Spoons people have already asserted he grew up in Poznan. But where did this information come from? Especially his exact birth date. The wiki page did cite its sources, but it only linked to a bunch of fairly generic celebrity info websites, some in Spanish and some in Portuguese, which simply listed this information about Tommy and nothing else. Where did they find this information? Nobody knows. Tommy's life is just so goddamn weird that it seems like the explanation for the remaining loose ends in his life story has got to be something too weird to even consider in most mysteries. I'd give credence to Tommy theories that I would immediately throw out the window if this were anybody else we were talking about, in declining order of plausibility. That Tommy is a mobster. Didn't he work at that reportedly mafia-connected Italian restaurant? That he was D.B. Cooper, as XKCD tried to suggest, and a different friend of mine brought that up, not knowing XKCD had already made that same joke. Unfortunately, D.B. Cooper's haul of money was a lot less than $6 million, and whoever that was, he definitely lost a substantial chunk of it when a kid dug up bills he had buried on a beach by the Columbia River. Or maybe Tommy truly is a vampire. According to Greg, he's kinda obsessed with them, once suggesting that his character in the room, Johnny, might be a vampire, even though the room was otherwise intended as a slice-of-life romantic drama without any supernatural elements. He had plans for a second movie after The Room that was going to be called The Vampire from Alcatraz, King of Vampires. And of course, Tommy Shore looks and talks like a vampire, and according to his former employee Aaron, quote, he never sleeps. Ever. Going through this man's past, dredging up distant events in an effort to find out his real backstory, I couldn't help being reminded, as odd as this is going to sound, of The Great Gatsby. I'm sorry to give you flashbacks to high school English class, but I really do love The Great Gatsby, and I've loved it ever since I first read it in, yes, high school English class. As your teacher definitely told you, The Great Gatsby is about the American dream, and about how no matter how rich you get, you can't really become a member of the elite without being born one. Tommy Wiseau is practically a real-life, turn-of-the-millennium Jay Gatsby. He's rich, he's successful, people love him, but he's gauche. He's certainly not like the other rich and famous people who occupy his social niche. Everybody wonders about his past. He keeps his past a secret, perhaps in order to stay in the elite club that he's managed almost entirely through luck to stumble his way into. He comes from destitute beginnings and was born far away from the centers of wealth and power under a different, though similar name. The one difference, I think, is that Tommy is living his best life. He may get defensive when people try to bring up his past, but he's certainly not afraid of the spotlight. To this day, you can catch him every now and then attending midnight screenings of The Room in various cities, speaking in front of Rocky Horror-style audiences who cosplay as characters in The Room and throw plastic spoons at the screen, an homage to the framed photos of spoons that inexplicably decorate the apartment where the movie takes place. If The Great Gatsby was about how the American dream is unattainable, the life story of Tommy Wiseau may carry the moral that the American dream is still unattainable, but that doesn't matter when you're having fun and don't give a fuck. And you know what? Tommy's mysterious past is fundamental to his appeal. I'm not sure I fully want to know where those millions came from. Yes, I'm itching to know, but the itching is the fun part. He's not just a funny guy who made the best worst movie of all time. He's a funny guy who made the best worst movie of all time and is an international man of mystery. If somebody approached me claiming to have the whole truth on Tommy Wiseau, asking me if I'd like to hear it, I would tell them to leave their stupid explanations in their pocket.